Good evening, everybody. Let's get started. Okay, so what are we going to do tonight? We're going to review a little bit just to establish some of the premises of our discussion until now. And we're going to go from that review straight into a discussion of Christianity and of Jesus, because he has been mentioned as a possible Messiah in casual conversation from time to time. We will also talk about, going in order of chronology, we'll talk about Shabtai Tzvi, or Shabtai Tzvi, depending on how you pronounce the Tet or the Tes. We'll talk about some lessons learned there. And then we will turn our attention to a modern-day controversy, which is the status of the Rebbe of Lubavitch, the deceased Rebbe of Lubavitch. I would say an important thesis in the discussion that we've been having till now has to do with the view of the Mashiach as what I would call, actually I think I borrowed this term, restorative, which means that the Mashiach is not an innovation. The advent of the King, the Mashiach, will not be the first time that the Jewish people has experienced many of the critical dimensions of the Mashiach. Quite the opposite. It will be a return to normalcy, and more important than a return to normalcy will be that the original intent of creation itself will be realized. So that we spent a lot of time, very rushed time, if you recall, in the first of the previous two sessions, discussing the flow of human history, looking at the antecedents of the Mashiach and the intention, so to speak, by the divine manipulator of history to plant the seeds of Mashiach in the world as soon as we find Adam HaRishon wandering and decaying, or having the mission decay. We find the seeds of Mashiach, and we actually documented what at the time I presented as probably the earliest indication of the relationship of Adam and his mission in the world, humanity and its mission in the world, and the Mashiach, when we talked about the well-known Medrash that Adam, who was intended originally to live 1,000 years, ends up living 930 years, and the Medrash says that he, with his prophetic vision, he gazes down in history and sees that there's this soul that is not going to make it, that needs to be there for redemption, and that's the soul of King David, and he cedes 70 years to King David. And so the obvious question is, why does he give 70 years to David HaMelech? There are many people in the world, and many who we probably would have liked to have longer, and many special and holy individuals. And the answer is that King David is nothing other than an extension and a manifestation of and the completion of the mission of Adam HaRishon, of Adam, because Adam was created specifically to unite the entire universe under God and to bring heaven and earth together in unison, in awareness of God as the Creator and a fulfillment of all of His commandments. Adam fails in that mission, but he's able to leave behind, so to speak, 70 years, which is the minimum lifetime, so to speak, is able to leave behind a human career out of which the seeds of the success of the human race and of God's purpose in the world will be realized. So we actually want to go back even beyond that to an earlier reference in the Torah, because I should have mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, and that is where the Torah describes the chaotic state of affairs before God intervenes to organize in an act of creation. And the Torah describes Bereishis bara Elokim es hashamayim ves haaretz. I'm not allowed to quote passages by heart, so let's go straight into the Chumash. The only passages you're allowed to quote by heart are passages that everybody knows by heart, because then there's no danger that you'll misquote them and get away with it. Torah is too important to misquote. And the land, the earth, was I'm quoting from this awkward English, was unformed and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. The Medrash goes through an extensive development of this second passage in the Torah and describes the four dominions, the four powers that will ultimately have dominion over Israel, the four exiles. And the Medrash then says, "V'ruach Elokim rachaves al pnei amayim," and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. Says the Medrash, that refers to the days of Mashiach. So here you have, at the very beginning, instilled into the world two supposedly diametrically opposed forces. One is the four dominions that obscure the mission of the people of Israel, that seek to subdue Israel so that Israel can't fulfill its mission, and that's already inserted into the world and into the potential, let's say, the kinetic energy of the world at the very beginning. And at the same time, you have V'ruach Elokim rachaves al pnei amayim. There's no choice. There is no way that we're not going to end up with the Spirit of God hovering over the face of the deep. That's going to be there. That's all built in. They are contradictory. Just trying to keep people moving here. They are contradictory. But if you look at it on a deeper level, you can appreciate that the four forces themselves that theoretically obscure the mission of the people of Israel, these four dominions, these four exiles, actually are the process by which and through which the people of Israel are going to realize their ultimate potential. That's the whole idea here. So that it's specifically through struggle, through smelting, through reaching God in spite of the obstacles, or seeing God in the obstacles, that we're ultimately going to bring the Melech HaMashiach. And that leads, of course, into some of the understanding that we talked about of the, shall we say, seedy seeds of Mashiach, because the Mashiach specifically comes from that part of the human endeavor which might seem to be unredeemable. And I would point out, by the way, that this is not a direct challenge or response or affront to a form of Christian theology, but it definitely is inconsistent with Christianity, in which we are willing to talk about and actually actually embrace a vision of the Mashiach coming from sources of defilement, as in all of these inappropriate sexual relationships, specifically because we don't see any insertion in the world of any manifestation of physicality or evil as anything other than from God. And ultimately, the point of Mashiach is going to be able to take everything in the world and unify it and explain it in the name of the Creator of the universe, who created every single force that exists and those forces serve His purpose. So we talked about the roots of the Mashiach, and therefore the idea that human history is marching forward towards that culmination, that was always the purpose in the first place. Whatever happens in Yemos HaMashiach is actually why the world was created in the first place. Mashiach is therefore not a solution to a problem. It's actually the other way around. The problems are a means to getting to the culmination. And so let's make an observation, which I think we've talked about a little bit, but I think is very important to our discussion of Christianity. The notion of Jesus as Messiah is so problematic that it almost really does not require discussion. Now, once we understand and read the Bible and simply understand what Mashiach is all about, you have to go through tortured explanations in order to be able to see the passages, and not just the passages, the whole trend of Jewish history, very difficult to see any resemblance whatsoever to the life and death of Jesus. That is the least of the challenges that the suggestion that Jesus is a Messiah or the Messiah presents to Judaism. When I say by challenge, I mean the least of the ideological challenges. Jesus being the Messiah is not a big problem. It's the context in which Jesus is offered as a Messiah, which I think we need to be aware of, because it is part and parcel of an entirely different worldview that differentiates Judaism from Christianity. That is this. First of all, as we've seen, we see Jewish world history as marching towards a certain climax, as marching towards a certain purposefulness that was already implanted at the very beginning of the world. We see redemption as actually happening in a very dramatic and historic and public scale. We see that the world itself, in a public and open way, under God, will be redeemed. We see the world itself as being the vehicle. We see human history. What's that?
What do you mean by being redeemed?
Redeemed from the obscuring of the presence of God in the world. That's how I would use the word redemption. A redemption from the illusion that there's anything but God that matters. So our notion of redemption is that the creator of the universe is known, that the people who God has chosen to rest his name, upon whom his name will rest, the people Israel, will be seen as God's people, will be seen as the ones who are the teachers of humanity, will be supported by humanity, and that human history itself will develop in such a way as to bring that out clearly. Interestingly enough, the messianic figure, meaning the Melech HaMashiach, the King, the Messiah, is not discussed in the Torah, in the five books of Moses. He is very specifically discussed in the prophets, but he is not discussed in the messianic visions that appear in the book of Deuteronomy, which are clearly a description of Achris HaYomim, of the end of days, and of the culmination of human history, in which Moshe Rabbeinu tells the children of Israel that they will ultimately be spread out around the world. God will ultimately gather us back in. We will repent. We will observe. Nowhere in there does Moshe Rabbeinu talk about the King of the Mashiach. Nowhere in there does Moshe talk about an individual who will do this. Why is that so? So I would suggest to you that is because of a very important angle that Judaism has on Mashiach, which is that it's not about the guy. It's not about the guy at all. It's really about God. The guy, meaning the Mashiach, the king, is nothing other than an agent to bring about realization. And therefore, when Moshe Rabbeinu is predicting what's going to happen at the end of days, he tells you what's going to happen. The main thing, the headline is, the Jews will serve God in unison and in full clarity and in full awareness. Those who opposed God by opposing the Jews, for that is the motivation for opposing the Jews, those that opposed God by opposing the Jews will experience retribution if they themselves don't repent, and human history will be concluded. It is not significant in terms of the headline of what Mashiach is all about the individual. The individual is not, because he's not a deity, he is not a miracle worker, according to Rambam, who is the Rebbe of the Jewish people and who is the mainstream accepted authority in these matters. Not the, but a mainstream accepted authority. The Mashiach won't be a miracle worker. He will therefore he will inspire us by the truth of his words and by the impact of his accomplishments, but not by his personality per se, and not by his overwhelming being, although he will clearly be a charismatic figure, and he will clearly be a leader, and he will clearly have major impact as a person. But the point is, his will be leadership of Torah, by Torah, for Torah, guided by Torah. He cannot deviate at all from Torah. If he does that, he is automatically excluded. It's all about that. So therefore, I'm trying to draw a contrasting picture between the notion of Jewish redemption, which is not about a figure, but really about an historic climax, and a climax that happens on the world stage using the entire history of the world itself and all of the tragedies in world history, so on and so forth on the one hand, and what I see in a Christian vision as a redemption from sin. First of all, the Redeemer is the Savior from sin, not the Savior from either exile or from the obscure nature of God and his connection with Israel, but rather the one who redeems man from sin by having suffered for for our sins. Why does he suffer for our sins? Because our sins are inevitable, because we are of the flesh, because we are of a physical universe. The physical universe itself has no real purpose and mission in helping us know God. It is really a distraction from our knowing God. And therefore we have this figure who is divine, who somehow God comes down in a divine form and somehow allows you, through holding on to him, figuratively speaking, to be saved from the inevitable physicality and sinfulness of that physicality, which is very other than God. It's not part of God. It's really a distraction from God. It's really the world of Satan, who would lure you from God and who would really fight the mission of God, who is not placed into the world by God to serve a purpose, but actually distorts the mission of God and is always trying to make sure that nobody knows about God. He's the anti-God or the Antichrist. And so, and I am very much oversimplifying things for the purpose of making an argument here. I am very much not talking subtly about Christianity. I think it's very important for anybody who talks about religions to admit when they make generalities about a complex system that they are making generalities, because our faith deserves subtlety, and even a faith that we don't believe in and that we think is absolutely false deserves subtlety. You can't discuss things if you don't have the subtleties. But I am making generalities for the purpose of making these points, that there is this notion that the world itself is beyond redemption in and of itself. It is other than God. It is separate from God. So, and redemption is very much an internal matter. It's very much an internal matter. He and she who embraces God through Jesus will be redeemed, and others won't. The world itself is outside of that picture to some significant degree. In a certain sense, that monotheistic faith really is grounded in certain polytheistic notions, because it allows for the possibility that there are certain forces in the world and certain entities that are brought into existence that actually don't serve God's purposes. And in that sense, while it does claim to be a monotheistic force of faith, it is also, at the same time, incorporative of dimensions of polytheism, and therefore is entirely, in its philosophy and theology, fairly abhorrent to Judaism. Now, the fact is that the biggest problem for believing Christians about Jesus is that the people that he was sent to redeem didn't buy it. Very, very hard to see a redeemer who comes into the world to redeem a people from their troubles, and they're bored by him. They're just bored, indifferent, certainly not following him, certainly rejected him. That's the biggest problem that Christianity has, because we're the ones who should have bought in, and that's why we're the prime targets for people who want to missionize and witness about Jesus. We're the ones who really hold the key to his success, because if the Jews buy in, then we're the ones who we were sent to redeem. It's much more geschmack to have a Jewish recruit than a Hindu recruit to Christianity, because the Hindus were not really an issue at the time that Jesus was rejected. You have also, we have to point out this piece as well, that Judaism is a faith of action, a faith of mitzvos. And all the way through the discussion of the Mashiach, Moshe Rabbeinu and all the Nevi'im are very clear that the end result of the work of Mashiach is going to be a return to observance and a return to the whole covenant of the law. We are very much about doing, because in our immersion in the physical universe and in our partnership with God in the physical universe, we elevate the world itself and use the world in the service of God, and therefore we don't really see anything inherently evil about in any commodity. Whereas Christianity is a faith which is largely, not entirely, but largely a faith, not a system of actions. There are actions that flow from that faith, there are actions that flow from certain attitudes, but it is not a system of mitzvot which emphasizes the immersion in physical undertakings. That is because of their general suspicion of the nature of physicality and the worthlessness, or worse, of the physical universe. And therefore, it's about faith, it's not about acts. It's about where you are in your heart and what you feel, and what the Spirit and how the Spirit moves you. So these are some of the observations I'm making, not so much about why Jesus is not the Messiah. Jesus is not the Messiah because we saw that all the predictions that come that describe what the Messiah will accomplish, Jesus didn't accomplish. The world still has war. The world still has suffering. The world still, in significant numbers, proportionately, denies the existence of God. And when a Messiah doesn't accomplish what he's supposed to accomplish, as we saw in Maimonides, then we know he's not the Mashiach. So it's really not a big problem. When we are accosted, or I shouldn't say accosted, when we are politely approached by people who believe that Jesus is the Messiah or that Jesus is God, very often we are confounded because they quote passages to us. And first of all, we have to understand that there is a problem in general that Christians have, and that is that they don't know the Bible. Certainly in its original. They know the Bible in some form of a translation. Some of them know the Bible in the original, but they certainly don't know the Bible with our Torah Shabbat Al-Peh, and most of them usually only know the passages that apply specifically to the Messiah out of context, and it is very easy to distort any part of the Bible anytime. I can prove anything in the entire world. I can prove God is dead for the Bible. So the problem is that we, unfortunately, the people of the book, don't know our own Bible well enough, and therefore we're very confused by people who seem very confident and fluent in passages in the Tanakh. But all you have to do is sit down and study through a chapter or two before and after whatever is being quoted before it becomes, on the face of it, just a spurious argument. There is really not a lot of intellectual discourse that goes into the issue of Mashiach and Jesus. I will tell you this. There's a very important passage in the Rambam in a section that was edited out by European censors centuries ago, which has made its way back into public awareness. Let me see, as a matter of fact, if this didn't bring it for this reason, but let me see if this particular issue of the Rambam contains it. The Rambam talks very specifically about Christianity. Yes. The Rambam in chapter 11, passage 4 of the Laws of Kings and Their Wars, which is the section in which he halachically codifies the laws of Mashiach, writes, quote, and we're joining him in progress, and you've seen these quotes in some of the things that I passed out in previous weeks. If a king arises from the house of David, fluent in Torah and involved in mitzvot, as David his father, according to the Torah, the written Torah and the oral Torah, and he compels all of Israel to go in the Torah and to strengthen themselves in it, and he fights the wars of God, then Harei Zeh Bechezkas Shehu Mashiach. These are the words, Harei Zeh, that behold, this person is Bechezkas Shehu Mashiach, the reasonable assumption that he is Mashiach. We are allowed to assume, he doesn't use the word allow, he just says, this person is in the status of an assumed Messiah. Im Asa V'Hitzliach, if he does it and he succeeds, v'notzach kol ha'umah shesvivav, and he prevails over all the nations around him, v'vona mikdash b'mekomo, and he builds the temple in its place, meaning if he builds a temple in Eilat, no good. V'kavatz nidchei Yisrael, and he gathers in the dispersed of Israel, harei zeh Mashiach b'vadai, then he is certainly Mashiach, meaning when is he certainly Mashiach? When he accomplishes what Mashiach is supposed to do. V'im lo hitzliach ad ko, if he does not succeed up till here, O Neharag, or he is killed, which means that he could not succeed, and which means that he hasn't yet succeeded, or he it's clear that he hasn't succeeded, or he is killed, not that he doesn't succeed because he's killed, he doesn't succeed, or he's killed. V'yodua she'eno zeh shehivticha alav Torah, it's clear that this is not the one that the Torah promised us about. He's like all other kings in the house of David who are complete and kosher, who died. And God, stood him up in his position where people thought that he might seriously be Mashiach, and then he died without being Mashiach. He was only put into that position to test the multitudes, who will be obviously disturbed that the person that they thought was the Messiah is not. Shenemar, and it says, as it says, alright, he quotes a passage from Yechezkel, and now here's the part that I wanted you to hear. I don't like to quote a Rambam out of context, particularly the Rambam. It's very important not to lift things out of context. In the middle of this law, he says, Af Yeshua Hanitzri, even Jesus the Christian, Shadima Sheyihya Mashiach, who imagined that he would be the Mashiach, v'neharag b'beizdin, and was killed in Beizdin. We're not going to deal with the movie issues of the Passion right now. Kvar nisnabi bo Daniel. Daniel, the prophet Daniel, already prophesied about him. Shenemar, upanai pritzi imach, yinasu lahamid chazom nikashelu. That I'm going to have this visionary who will rise, and they will be, they will stumble on him. V'chiyesh michshal gadol mizeh, says the Rambam. Is there a greater stumbling block than this? Shekol ha-Nevi'im dibru sh'ha-Mashiach gol Yisrael l'Mashiach. That all the prophets speak about the Mashiach, the Redeemer of Israel, and their Savior. U'mekabetz nidcheyem, and the one who gathers in their exiles. U'mechazek mitzvasan, and strengthen their mitzvahs. V'zeh garam la'abed Yisrael b'cherev. This person caused, I think he means, in his name, caused Israel to be, many Jews to be lost, becherev, in the sword, lefazer sheirisam, and to have their remnants scattered, lahashpilam, and to lower them and subdue them, lahachliv haTorah, and to forge or miss or replace the Torah, ulahatos rov haolam, and to mistakenly mislead most of the world, la'avad al kami baladei Hashem, to serve a god other than God. So that's a terrible thing. Aval, says the Rambam, however, machshavos barei olam ein koch ba'adam lahasigam. There's no way that a human being can totally penetrate the mind of the creator of the universe. Kilo darcheinu v'drachav v'lo machshavoseinu machshavosavi. His ways are not our ways. I should say it the other way. Our ways are not his ways, and our thoughts are not his thoughts. Says the Rambam, v'chol hadvarim ha'elu sheyeshua ha'notzri. All these matters of Jesus, the Christian, v'shozeh ha'yishma'eli, and this Ishmaelite, she'amar acharav, who stood after him. He's talking about, obviously, Muhammad in the 6th century. Einan ela liyasha derech lemelech ha-Mashiach. They are nothing other than to smooth the path of the King of the Mashiach, ulesakenus ha-olam kulo la'avodas Hashem b'yachad, and to prepare the world entirely to serve God in unison. As it says, and he quotes a passage, ki oz ha-hapoch elamim sofa b'ra l'krod kulam b'shem Hashem la'avod Hashem b'chad. That passage envisions the entire world serving God in one name. So the Rambam says, Ketzad, how does it work? Kvar nisma, this is an entire passage that's been lifted from most of the texts of the Rambam. Kvar nisma le ha'olam kulam b'divrei ha-Mashiach, u'midivrei ha-Torah, u'midivrei ha-Mitzvos. The entire world has been filled with words and talk of Mashiach, and words of Torah, and words of Mitzvos. U'pashtu dvarim e'elu b'iyim rechokim. And these concepts have spread to distant isles. U'va'amim rabim. And in many nations of uncircumcised hearts, and they're dealing and conversing in these matters, elu, some say that these mitzvahs were true, and they no longer apply nowadays, and they're not supposed to be practiced forever. Others say that there are hidden things here, and it doesn't mean what they really seem to mean. And the Mashiach has come, and has revealed the hidden intent, which is different than the open intent. So therefore, the point is that the conversation about the Mashiach has been brought to the fore because of the fact that there have been these people who have been held up as the Messiah, causing the conversation to happen around the world. And this is a way of, as the Rambam says, l'sakin es ha'olam kulo, to prepare the world entirely, to put, so to speak, the Mashiach issue on the agenda. U'kishiyamad ha-melech ha-Mashiach be'emes, when the king Mashiach finally rises into his position truthfully, v'yatzliach, and succeeds, v'yarum, and will be exalted, you'd say, and be elevated. Miyad hen kolim chuzrim. At that point, kulan chuzrim, they will all return. The yodim shesheker nachal abaseim. They will know that they inherited falsehood from their ancestors. and that their prophets and their ancestors misled them. So the point is that they're prepared. It's kind of like a bridge. If you take people who are worshiping cows and you tell them to believe in one God, it's going to be quite an adjustment for them. So the idea is to get the world to begin a conversation about monotheism, and even while they claim to be monotheistic, they may still have certain traces or significant traces of idolatry and other forms, but at least the conversation has begun, and therefore the world is prepared, so to speak, like a bridge for this thing. This is the Rambam, a very interesting approach that the Rambam has, which has other applications perhaps later on in history. So this is the issue with Mashiach. I want to ask you if there, before we go on with Jesus and Mashiach, I want to ask you if there's any particular burning issue, particularly with Jesus and Mashiach, other than doesn't the passage say that he is? No. The answer is no. Don't even try me. Okay? Other than that, are there any questions about Christianity and Mashiach? Yes. Jesus is what?
He's co-equal with God.
Yeah, that's part of the problem.
Isn't that a bigger problem even than the Mashiach part? You are
correct, and I did open that discussion, and that would have been appropriate to include. I was trying to limit myself to what, in my mind at least, in my mind only, there's no objective reality here, related to the issues of Mashiach themselves. Itself, and therefore I didn't talk about it. But there's no question, theologically speaking, there are many serious problems with a human being being God. Serious problems, and you know, the blood and the flesh and so on and so forth. Those are like totally alien to Judaism from a variety of perspectives. So thank you for mentioning that. But when we're talking about Jesus as Mashiach and that is God, that's why I didn't emphasize that too much. Yes. The question has to do with the lineage and the ancestry of Jesus, because obviously if Jesus is going to be the Messiah that's discussed by the prophets, then he has to come, V'yotza Chote Megeza Yishai, he has to come from the house of Jesse, he has to come from David. So you're asking about the lineage. So there are at least two tortured attempts to put Jesus out of the house of David, and both of those attempts have different lineages. So we first of all can't trust either of them because we don't know which one is accurate. But any of them are going to be problematic because Jesus has no father. Sometimes you don't need to say anything. You just say the fact and it just speaks for itself. Yes, yes.
Don't you think it's possible that God comes to the earth in the body of man?
I don't think anything. The Judaism that I know does not entertain that. No, and I want, if you're asking me a question because you want to know what I think, I just answered you. If you want to convince me of what you want me to think, we'll have to have that conversation at another time. Yes?
You sort of accuse Christianity of a kind of a Gnosticism, that it rejects the idea that the physical universe is a part of God's plan or the physical universe will be redeemed.
Thanks.
And I find you to be a very thoughtful and articulate person, but I don't know how much Christian theology you read. And I don't mean by that to slight you.
I don't read any.
Christianity has quite a history of speaking of creation theology, speaking of the redemption of creation. It's a very important idea in Paul's writings. I was curious how that helps your case. I know you were trying to say the worldviews of Christianity and Judaism are opposed, therefore the idea that Jesus is the Messiah has a problem. But I don't see where your critique is coming from, because Christianity... Maybe there's some versions or shallow versions of Christianity that have said something like that. But the importance of creation in Christianity and of the creation being redeemed and returning to God, Eden, is very important.
Yes. So let me make a general observation. First of all, let's assume that I said what it sounds like I said, and let's assume that you corrected me. So I stand corrected, and Christianity cannot be rejected on the grounds of the argument that I made. Let's leave that. That's number one. Number two, I will not be surprised to find traces of everything that Judaism says somewhere in Christianity, because Christianity has a major problem. It claims to be Judaism. So it's going to have a lot of Judaism in it. So anytime you want to point to authenticity in Christianity, you're going to find some vestige, at least, that is not exactly the same thing that Judaism says, but close close to it. You know, as kids, when we grew up, we would always, you know, marvel that the Christians had this Palm Sunday and they're walking around with these palm branches. They were only 6 months off because they would do it. They would do it in April and not in October or whatever it is. And then we would love to see the Pope walking around with a yarmulke. And we sent. And basically, we knew that Christianity was kind of like, yeah, we're Jewish too, but they just don't get it right. So they're also. There's going to be a lot of claims to authentic Judaism, and it's going to be mixed in. So the problem with Christian theology, the little that I know of it, I'm not interested in Christian theology because it doesn't affect me. If I was involved more in the dialogue with other people, I would need to be more interested in it. Right now I'm involved with the dialogue with my own people, and Christianity is just not an issue. But the problem is, if little that I know of Christian theology, there are many different strains of thought that are all incorporated together. So the classic example is the Trinity. The Trinity, just the concept of three anything, the Godhead or whatever it is, and the one God. And they're pointing to passages in the Torah that talk about multiplicity of God and so on and so forth while he is one. All that stuff is a major struggle of Christianity itself. As far as I know from my amateurish reading, they've never really fully resolved. So that's an issue in Christianity. But your point is well taken. I will cease and desist from making theological statements about Christianity because I don't know what I'm talking about. Yes?
Is there any concept of a suffering
is there an idea that the Mashiach is going to suffer? You're talking about the Rambam's response to a suffering Messiah in Yemen, in a group of Jews in Yemen who are corresponding with Maimonides. I'm not familiar with that as a major theme. There is definitely a lot of suffering in Jewish life, and the prophets talk about the Jewish people suffering. And obviously, it's convenient to make that be the Mashiach. By the way, there are a lot of candidates in Judaism who suffered a lot for God. And nobody's claiming they're a Mashiach. Suffering is not, nobody has a monopoly on suffering. Yes?
Can you tell me, after all of this talk, that Jesus, or what some people, the Messianic Jews, call him Joshua or Yeshua, that he really exists? Because there's no description anywhere of what he looked like. And I'm talking about according to Judaism. Was there such a person who was a teacher, a rabbi, and so forth and so on? Because all the books about him and his life were written 200-300 years later, the Gospel of Paul and
they're all
contradicting each other.
Okay, so the answer is I don't know, but in this sense, I relate to Jesus as if he did exist, for the purposes of discussing or assimilating beliefs in Jesus or rejecting them, I assume that what Christians say happened. And by that, I reject everything about him as authentic. There may be, I don't know. It doesn't matter to me. If he didn't exist, I certainly don't believe in him. If he did exist, I have more reason not to believe in him. The more he existed, the bigger problem I have with him. Okay, that's the problem. So it's irrelevant to me. Because of...
So, yeah.
Right. Okay.
So,
well, I don't mock the whole thing. We have a bunch of weird stuff in our religion too, which anybody could stand up here and mock as well if we didn't understand it. So I'm going to assume I don't understand it, but I do assume certain basic things. I do know that Jesus contradicted things in the Torah. He clearly openly does according to what the New Testament says. That's enough for me. So it doesn't matter. Let's move on. We come to the matter of Shabtai Tzvi, or Shabtai Tzvi. Let's get the facts first before we try to analyze a little bit. This is difficult because, first of all, it's difficult to find thoroughly reliable sources on Shabtai Tzvi because there is the matter of how you interpret the role of people who were suckered into believing in him. So if you are a historian who doesn't want to talk about people who believed in him with disparity, then you may record certain things about the Shabtai Tzvi thing. Let's get what we seem to know are the facts. He was born in 1626. When he's about 22 years old, We are given to understand that that is the beginning of the time that he began to think of himself, at least sometimes, as a Mashiach. In 1650, by the way, he lived in Smyrna, just down the road. In 1650, after already having expressed some messianic, we will now call them delusions because now we know he wasn't because he's dead and the world is still in a mess. He almost drowned in a swimming incident and he was saved, and he considered that to be another miraculous indication that he is truly destined to be something very special. The rabbis of Smyrna banish him from the city. There's even evidence that he was flogged. He wanders through Turkey and Greece and Albania for about 7 years. He was a scholar. He was a Kabbalist. He was, and we have to understand the role of Kabbalah at that time, was becoming very prominent. And we'll find that through the incident of Shabbosai Tzvi, Kabbalah itself ends up suffering because of his misuse and abuse of Kabbalah to reinforce his stand. But he was a scholar. He was evidently a very charismatic fellow, evidently very appealing. And he was able, in his wanderings, to use his scholarship to retain a very good reputation wherever he went. In spite of the fact that his behavior was very erratic, he violated many precepts of Jewish law, even in the earlier stages. Later on, we find that he's the horror of horrors in terms of his Jewish behavior. But even in the earlier years, he was very irregular in his observance of Jewish law. In Constantinople in 1658, as best I can determine, he was almost put in cherem, a rabbinic excommunication. And somewhere after that, early 1660s or somewhere around there, he returns to Smyrna and ends up founding something resembling a new faith. Actually, it does not even seem to be calling it Judaism. What it was exactly, I can't determine. I myself do not know. What it was premised on, I'm not sure. I'm not sure he knew, but it could be that he did, and I don't know. In 1662, he leaves and he goes to Egypt, and from Egypt he goes to the Holy Land. He left to his own devices would probably not even be anybody we'd be talking about now, with all of his chachma and all of his charisma and everything like that. Problem is, he had a great sidekick. And actually, he was really the sidekick of this great asset, who we will call derisively Nasan HaNavi. Those of you who know the real Nasan HaNavi, Lahavdil, the prophet Nathan, who lives during King David's time. There's another prophet Nathan of Aza, of Gaza, who has this prophetic vision. He claims that Shabbosai Tzvi is the Mashiach, and he really begins to push the notion that Shabbosai Tzvi is Mashiach. Now, the vision happens after he meets Shabbosai Tzvi. I don't mean the night afterwards. I mean that he was already quite aware of Shabbosai Tzvi from his travels from Egypt through to the Holy Land. And it seems to me that he was quite impressed with the individual. Shabbosai Tzvi is an indication of his charisma and his ability to influence people with his personality, that people like Nathan of Gaza were so taken by him. Nathan also evidently was somebody who was more than dabbling in serious scholarship and in Kabbalah. From the sources that I look at, it seems that Shabbosai Tzvi is seen as having succumbed to the persuasion of the prophet Nathan of Gaza that he is a Mashiach, and he starts believing it. At first he humbly denies it, then he says, "Oh shucks, I guess I am." And meanwhile, for example, in 1665, there's a record of him actually marrying this woman named Queen Sarah, who was a known adulteress. And the prophet Nathan is in a position of explaining a whole myriad of weird non-Jewish behaviors that Shabbosai Tzvi has undertaken, that humiliated the Torah and denigrated our faith. And this is one of them. And he has all kinds of creative ways of explaining what Shabbosai Tzvi is doing. You can see, for example, that if I'm sitting willing to talk to you about the antecedents of Mashiach and talk about Lot and his daughters, you can see how a creative Kabbalist might be able to say that Shabbosai Tzvi is Mashiach and he should be having a relationship with an adulterous woman. There are discussions and rumors about miracle cures and supernatural events, other miraculous things associated with him, and word spreads. It gets to the point where people around the, let's say, Jewish communities around the Mediterranean with access to ports in great numbers are beginning to travel to Israel because Mashiach is coming and Shabbosai Tzvi is it. And they take it very seriously. Now, let's understand the context. This is right after the Gzeros Taftatat. This is right after the period of time in Jewish history, the Shemanitsky massacres, where horrors have been experienced by the Jewish community, the likes of which they never, ever contemplated. And in 1648, the end of those Gzeros, the end of that period of time, where you would have days where 6,000 Jews in a day would be butchered, and not just butchered. It's not like people went through with machetes and just chopped off people's heads. I will not go into it because I can't bring myself to say it, but I'm sure from your reading you're familiar with the unbelievably creative horror that these massacres brought upon pregnant women and children and the suffering that they forced people to go through before they themselves were put to horrible deaths. And so you can imagine the state of mind of the children of Israel in European nations prior to this. And then you have this very knowledgeable, very scholarly, charismatic figure who is far away. He's in the land of Israel. You've got this prophet claiming that he is the Messiah, that this man is the Messiah. You're not necessarily fully aware of everything. This is not the age of the internet. This is not the age of the fax. This is not the age of the telephone. This is not the age of the telegram. This is not the age of even a pigeon. There's no mail, right? So what you hear is people coming on boats. What you hear is pieces of stories to validate or otherwise to verify or to deny a certain rumor takes sometimes years. Meanwhile, you're desperate, and in a certain sense, the story of Shabbosai Tzvi is a story about the emunah, about the faith of the Jewish people, that at a time like this, they could actually start believing in such great numbers that the Mashiach is about to come and reveal himself, or that he has revealed himself. I'm not sure if they thought he hadn't been revealed or he was revealed. I don't know if there was that discussion, but people in great numbers to the point where non-Jewish society is aware that the Jews are leaving for Israel. They're leaving in that great numbers. They're closing up shops. They're selling businesses. They're getting on ships in great numbers and going to Israel. Even Western Europe, where we will refer to the Jewish communities as more sophisticated, more intellectual, more modern in terms of the 1600s, even they were overtaken with a tremendous messianic zeal. Even many scholars, many rabbis supported this. First of all, there was a reawakening of commitment to Jewish observance. Let's understand, the people who followed Shabbosai Tzvi did not follow Shabbosai Tzvi because they said, he is a violator of Jewish law, but it doesn't matter, we think he's the Messiah. They thought he was the Messiah, and they therefore started observing Jewish law, because they were sure that the Messiah was coming. And therefore, many rabbis saw this as a tremendous reawakening. Like, what can you lose? You got Jews coming back to the faith and coming back to observance. It is unclear how many scholarly rabbis supported this messianic fervor, knowing that there were difficulties with Shabbosai Tzvi, and how many supported it, thinking that Shabbosai Tzvi was nothing other than a Torah scholar who was appealing to the highest inclinations of the Jewish people. It's unclear, I think, to anybody exactly, but. There were certain rabbis who were obstinate in their opposition, even from the beginning. Of Yaakov Sesportis of Amsterdam wrote a famous treatise. I think it was called, if I remember correctly, the Tzitz Novel, which was a long discussion of why Shabbosai Tzvi could not be taken to be Mashiach. And he actually lost his position, lost his community, was run out of town. But maintained his opposition to Shabbosai Tzvi. There were famous and very well-known authorities in the Shulchan Aruch, like the Taz, who were supposedly associated with beliefs in Shabbosai Tzvi. There's a famous story that the Taz, Rav David Halevi, sent his son to check out Shabbosai Tzvi, sent him to Israel, where Shabbosai Tzvi was in Jerusalem at first. And according to the story, he came they said that Shabbosai Tzvi, the Mashiach, was resting. And he approached his tent or his abode, I don't know exactly what it was, didn't hear that part with accuracy, and he sees Shabbosai Tzvi reclining on his back. And that was enough for him. He went back to Europe and reported to his father that he saw Shabbosai Tzvi lying on his back. That alone was already enough for him to know that the guy was nishke mensch, so to speak. Because the Gemara says, lo yishan prakdan, a person should not lie on his back, because to have your body facing upwards to heaven that way is considered to be significantly non-humble, and is considered to be the position of a unrefined human being. And even to this day, refined religious men do not sleep straight up on their back, because it's not considered to be respectful to the Almighty. So that alone is when the Taz said, that's it. If he's prakdan, so to speak, if he's lying on his back, then that's it. Obviously, there's something wrong with this guy. Right? They didn't know the rest. They didn't know the rest. That was enough. Yet, he came back with gifts, and other people used that as a sign that he approved, and that the Taz, Rav David Halevi, was associated with him. It was a tremendous fervor. You cannot, it's hard to, if you read the literature, it's hard to imagine. Especially nowadays, there cannot be this kind of messianic fervor, because we have a people that is 90-something% so ignorant of the concept of a human being who might be Mashiach that they can't get excited about anything. They're not looking for Mashiach. So you can't imagine, when you're talking about an overwhelming majority of the Jewish people who believes and still davens every day and practices and understands that there's going to be a Mashiach and still has a memory of the temple and so on and so forth. It's a different world back in the 1600s. Anyway, ultimately he installs himself as some kind of an emperor in Turkey. And the Sultan of Turkey doesn't exactly like that. So and he announces that he's going to liberate Yerushalayim, and there's all kinds of licentious sexual behavior, and he eats non-kosher food, and he creates a new bracha. Those of you who are familiar with the davening will appreciate this. We have a bracha that talks about Matir Asurim, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu releases the confined, releases those who are bound up. So he wrote a bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Matir Isurim, who permits that which was previously prohibited, because the law has changed, because this is the messianic era. So it sounds like Purim Torah, but this is, you understand, this is a serious leader. This is somebody that people are looking to and changing their lives for, and moving halfway across the globe during a time when you lost your life to try to go from somewhere in Europe to Israel. So we're talking about a major movement over here, led by a person who himself is outside the pale in terms of a Jewish practice. So the Sultan exiles him to a city in Turkey whose name I can't pronounce. Anybody know this? Gallipoli. Okay, Gallipoli. Anyway, so he puts him there supposedly in jail. But this jail, the guy was so popular that he bribes the guards. And it was evil for him to bribe the guards, because everybody's sending Shabbosai Tzvi all kinds of things, so he's got plenty to spare. And therefore he ends up having this great royal jail term over there. And finally, he says he's going to go to liberate Jerusalem. He's going to go, so the emperor, the Sultan can't take this. Finally, in September of 1666, he's dragged before the Sultan, and he's said, listen, I hear that you think you're the Messiah, you're going to liberate me. He says, no, not true. I'm not the Messiah at all. He says, well, convert to Islam or die. And what does he do? He converts to Islam. And Shabbosai Tzvi, the Melech HaMashiach, the Redeemer of Israel, the one who was going to bring the Jews from exile, the one who caused the tumult, the whole Western world is watching what's going on over here, watching the Jews yearn for the Redeemer and get excited about the Redeemer. So much so, by the way, that there are records of Jews turning against their former Jewish oppressors and saying that now that the Mashiach has come, we're going to get even with you for the way you treated us. That's how secure they were that the Mashiach was here. So this guy converts to Islam. So that's the end of the story. No, it's not. It's not the end of the story. Most people were horribly dismayed. Most people understood the Mashiach converts to Islam, he's not the Mashiach. We have made a terrible, terrible mistake, and there's a terrible, terrible Chilul Hashem. But that wasn't the end of it. There were people who said, no, this is part of the story. The Mashiach is supposed to do this. There's a reason that he converted to Islam. And they resorted to Kabbalistic sources that explained that it's actually predicted that the Mashiach is going to do this kind of a thing, and it's part of the need to go into choshech, into darkness, to uplift darkness, and so on and so forth. Never mind that the Rambam, for example, who even then is an authority, not even then, especially then, Rav Yosef Karo has written the Shulchan Aruch based on the Rambam. He takes them word for word wherever he can, only deviates when he has to from the words of the Rambam. And that's the Code of Jewish Law, which has come out at this time. So the Rambam is the Rebbe of Klal Yisrael, so to speak. And the Rambam is very clear that he can't deviate from Jewish law and practice. But no, he must be Mashiach. He was Mashiach. He said he was Mashiach. He did miracles. And they resorted to all kinds of devices to rationalize the fact that he still is Mashiach. By the way, there's a sect that's still in Turkey. A friend of mine told me that he received an email last year. He told me he received an email last year from a group in Turkey that considers themselves to be the followers of the descendants of these followers, the Shabtai Tzvi, and that this individual and this individual wanted to know how could these people rejoin the Jewish people. And his response was, by converting, like everybody else. So, but this is an indication of how much of a grip he had on at least some people. Now, obviously, from this event, this is not just an isolated story. This event has major implications. Because, first of all, the prestige and the authority of the rabbinate as an institution is terribly damaged by this affair. Because you had major authorities who went along with this. And after everybody's hopes are so dashed, people turn to the rabbis and say, how could you let this happen? How could you stand by and watch this happen? How could you not see that this guy was going to convert to Islam? And so on and so forth. How could you not have known about his behaviors? And so on and so forth. So that's number one. Number two, people's hopes were brought to a tremendously high level and then dashed. And when that happens, and you actually believe that your faith in Mashiach and the faith of your ancestors was going to be realized, and then all of a sudden it's taken away, so it's a major test. Some people survive such a test, others don't. And some historians see this as the beginning of a turn by Jews in significant numbers to other sources of salvation, whether it be the beginning of a falling away from the idea of halacha as authoritative and organizing Jewish life around something other than halacha, whether it be moves generally towards assimilation, whether it be just the idea that rabbis don't really know what they're talking about. Any of you who still respect rabbis, you are really an anachronism. Because I'm serious, you have no idea. Whatever notion of respect there is for rabbis nowadays is nothing compared to the authority and the power that rabbis had in Jewish life after the destruction of the temple, all the way down through the Middle Ages. So this is a major shift over here. And a major Chilul Hashem. The world itself sees the Jews following a Mashiach, and then this guy becomes a Muslim. Yes?
What did this man do? I mean, he doesn't have anything to do with rebuilding the temple. I mean, what did he... obviously, he was charismatic and learned, but what was it that indicated that he was in any way...
I don't know. He was, because the proof that he might be is that look at how many people are coming because they think he is. See, it's kind of like circular logic. But look how many people, that kind of a thing. There was no specific thing that they pointed to that said, this proves that he is Mashiach, as far as I know. No specific accomplishment. Other than he used Kabbalah. And by the way, that leads to another important point here. You may be familiar with Rabbi Yaakov Emden's famous dictum, in which he said that the Zohar is an authoritative source. The Zohar, repository of Kabbalistic wisdom, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's writings of Kabbalah. The Zohar is authoritative except when it is in conflict with the Gemara, with the Babylonian Talmud. Now that was a response to the messianism and the mixture of mysticism and Kabbalism that was used to support Shabtai Tzvi outside of Halakha. So this was an assertion by Rav Yaakov Emden that Halakha supersedes any of these other things. And it's interesting, for example, if you look at the Rambam, because Hilchas Mashiach is the Rambam. The Rambam codifies the laws of Mashiach. This is not just, when I quote you these Rambams over these past 2 or 3 weeks, we're not talking about a philosopher here. We're talking about the Rambam, the rationalist, in a law book codifying the laws of Mashiach. The Rambam is extremely rational in the sense of a rationalist in describing Mashiach. And he insists that there won't be miracles, and he insists that the Mashiach is going to be a regular human being, and there's no reference in the Rambam to any kind of secret kind of Kabbalistic incantations or whatever it is. It's very straightforward. The Rambam is very factual. How are you going to know if he's Mashiach? How are you going to know when for sure he's Mashiach? There's a halacha, so to speak. So, and yet, many, many Jews evidently fell away from a rational and structured assessment of this fellow, and allowed themselves to be distracted by interpretations of obscure sources that they knew nothing about. Okay. And also bear in mind, the printing press is only 200 years old, which means that, you know, you and I, we think it's normal that we go, anywhere we go, we find an art scroll translated Gemara with pictures of the insides of an animal, and it's on everybody's shelf. And anything you want to know, you look up, or you go to the internet and you just do a Google search for Mashiach, whatever it is, and you get everything you want to know. So, you know, who says that every Jew had a Rambam on his shelf? If he had a Rambam, it may have been handwritten by somebody, and it might be one in the city. And who said that everybody in all the small cities had more than 3 Gemaras? And if they had 3 Gemaras, who said that they had the whole entirety of Masechah Sanhedrin with all the passages? So we're talking about a totally different world over there. So you had to be an unbelievable scholar. And by the way, there were scholars who wanted to oppose it, who knew that if they opposed it, they'd be lost. Nobody would talk to them because it was such fervor. So we're talking about people who lost their ability to even speak with authority because they felt that it was better for the Jewish community to listen to them on most matters and not to say anything about this matter. It was a major challenge. So these are some of the implications, so to speak, and the effects of the Shabbosai Tzvi story. So I guess you could say that there is this is an example of human beings who create a rationale for something after the fact to fit the sources which they claim are the original sources, because of the cognitive dissonance which is created by an event which is totally out of kilter from what they expected to happen. This is what happens. I would say that one of the important messages that we have to take out of this is that we have to be extremely rigorous. While we have to be faithful, and while we have to believe, and while we are told by the Rambam that a person who denies any of the 13 principles of faith is counting himself outside of the faith body of the people of Israel, and therefore a person who does not anticipate and yearn for Mashiach is in denial of one of the principles of faith, it is also true that we've got to be rigorous in analyzing who Mashiach is and who Mashiach is not. And even when we are desperate, and the time will come, we should be desperate now. And by the way, who's not desperate? The only people who are not desperate are people who don't read the front page of the New York Times. Serious, who's not desperate? I mean, we grimace for 30 seconds when a mother with 4 babies is shot at point blank range in a car, and that's just yesterday's bad news. Let's wait till tomorrow, because who knows what tomorrow's bad news is. This is, these are not the massacres of Tachvatat, but this is not a good time for the Jewish people, and we desperately yearn for salvation and for redemption. But we have to yearn for it, but we also have to be rigorous in our approach to throwing ourselves after Mashiach. And that's why it's the era more than the individual that we are really obsessed with. We need to talk about the controversies, to the degree that they are controversies, of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Let me say this. I purposely didn't pass this around before because I don't want it to be a major distraction. It's going to be a distraction from what I'm saying now. When I say controversy, first let me say this. There's controversy only where there are 2 different opinions. If nobody disagrees with what I'm saying, it's not controversial. It's only controversial if somebody disagrees with the things that I'm suggesting. So that's number one. Number two is, let's approach the discussion about the Lubavitcher Rebbe with the reverence that it should be had. First, number one, we're talking about the Rebbe who brought thousands and thousands and thousands of Jews to Judaism. We're talking about the Rebbe who, even if he didn't bring thousands of Jews to Judaism, which he did, but Jews who were already in Judaism, he was the Rebbe of these people, which a Rebbe means not an intellectual master who presented Torah knowledge in lectures to people. He was the spiritual father of an entire movement that was devoted to the well-being of the broad masses of the Jewish people. The Lubavitch, as we all know, is founded on the concept of Ahavas Yisrael, love of fellow Jews, devotion to Klal Yisrael, bringing redemption to the world, and a tremendous Mesiras Nefesh sacrifice for the well-being of the Jewish people. These are the hallmarks of Chabad and of the Shluchim and of the message of the Rebbe, and this is what the Rebbe's life was all about. So we have to recognize that, and we have to say that with reverence, and whenever we're talking about something like that, we have to really tremble. So that is not even subject to dispute. And I would say that the Jewish map has been changed in so many different ways because of the accomplishment and the work of Chabad. And not only the Jewish map, but the Jewish mindset has been changed. Because although Chabad is not the only forerunner of the notion of turning to unaffiliated, otherwise secular Jews with love and devotion, trying to bring them back to the ways of the Torah, they certainly are a major pioneer in this whole notion. And they were doing it in major and organized ways well before most any other segment of the Jewish people was doing it. So all this has to be recognized. And as a matter of fact, this is one of the reasons that during the lifetime of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, during the time that he existed as a walking human being, during that time, it was possible for many people to suspect that the Lubavitcher Rebbe could be Mashiach, in the sense that here is a man who is devoted to the Torah, who's devoted to the Jewish people, who's devoted to bringing redemption to the world, and who talked about it all the time, who encouraged his Hasidim to try to bring redemption. And there's nothing wrong with somebody harboring a suspicion that this man is great enough to be the one that we've been waiting for 2,000 years. Nothing wrong with that. It's reasonable. There are many people who respected Lubavitch who did not think that the Lubavitcher Rebbe would turn out to be Mashiach, but they didn't think that if you thought that he was Mashiach, that you were guilty of anything other than believing passionately that your Rebbe was so great and powerful in a positive sense, effective, that he could actually turn out to be the influence that would transform the entire world and bring about Yemos HaMashiach. Very reasonable. However, the Rebbe died. He died. And when he died, the redemption had not come. When he died, there were still a majority of the Jewish people unaware of Lubavitch and unaware of God, right? There is still a majority of the human race not monotheistic, not aware of the oneness of God. There was still persecution of Jews. There was no temple. There was no ingathering of the exiles fully. There was definitely an ingathering of the exiles, a significant part of which Chabad had something to do with, and the Rebbe had something to do with, in the sense that Russian Jews may have had a mindset of more self-awareness because of the work of Chabad behind the Iron Curtain during times when nobody else is working behind the Iron Curtain, or very few other people were working behind the Iron Curtain. But it's not reasonable there to say that the Rebbe was the key figure in the ingathering of the millions of Jews that came from Yemen and Morocco and from America and from other parts of the world and so on and so forth. He certainly was involved in with fervor with the notion that Jews are going to go back to Israel at some point. But nothing that we expect of the Mashiach to happen happened. And therefore, the only thing is that up until the time that he died, even during the time that the Rebbe was in a coma and he was not functional and he was not articulate and he was not seeing people and he was not communicating with people verbally, during that time, it would not be unreasonable to say that some form of divine intervention would cure him and heal him, and he would walk and talk again, and he would walk among the living and continue his mission and continue the ingathering of the exiles and perhaps cause some unbelievable and unprecedented things to happen that would never happen before. Once he died, then that's exactly what the Rambam says. And I want to read you this halacha one more time. You have it if you brought your material from last week. And I think, oh, one second, in the handout I gave you now, you have the Rambam here, the first section, Rabbi Akiva, this is in the middle of, in progress, the Rambam discussing the whole question of who's going to be Mashiach, what kind of person. Rabbi Akiva, one of the greatest sages of the Mishnah, was one of the supporters of King Ben Kaziva, this Bar Kokhba, and would describe him as the King Mashiach. He and all the sages of his generation considered him to be the King Mashiach until he was killed because of his sins. Once he was killed, they realized that he was not the Mashiach. Okay, so that's a key line there. Because as soon as the person's life ends and he hasn't accomplished what Mashiach is supposed to happen, and that's the definitive standard that the Rambam uses, has he accomplished what Mashiach is supposed to accomplish, then it, by definition he's not the Mashiach. So then you have one of several possible ways to go. Terrible sadness and devastation if you hoped he was Mashiach and suspected he was Mashiach, and a terrible disappointment and no crisis in faith because you're a believer in God as the King of the Universe, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe as a human being who is a disciple of the Torah, who's a teacher of Torah, and he accomplished much, and you rejoice in, and celebrate his accomplishments, and you continue to live his mission, but you realize he wasn't the Mashiach as you hoped he would be, and therefore you don't have any other candidates, and you feel kind of hopeless, although you realize that God can do miracles. He could heal somebody suddenly from a stroke and let him continue his mission, or he can develop another person that you don't know about who could be Mashiach, but you're devastated and you're sad and you're hopeful and you yearn every day for the coming of Mashiach. That's what I maintain a reasonable Jew should do. There are, however, significant numbers of people who did not respond that way. There are significant numbers of ardent, intelligent, sophisticated followers of Chabad, of Lubavitcher Rebbe, who responded in a variety of different ways other than saying that's the end of the story with Mashiach regarding our Rebbe. There are those who said that the Rebbe didn't really die. I know one of them myself, who lived in this town, who told me that the Rebbe did not die. He is underground, but he is not dead. And he meant in a physical sense. He did not mean in a spiritual sense, in the sense that my Rebbe has never died for me. He lives for me every day. He didn't mean that at all. He meant that he is still living. It's just that there's the appearance of dying and so on and so forth. And he didn't make up that theology himself. He got that from a body, from other people who encouraged him to believe that. Then there are still others that say, yes, of course the Rebbe died. We saw that he died, he was buried, but the Rebbe is still Mashiach, or might still be Mashiach. There are two different things. He is still a Mashiach, we know that he's a Mashiach, and we will continue to refer to him in terms of Mashiach, and actually say, Yechi Adonainu Mareinu V'Rabbeinu Melech HaMashiach La'olam V'ed, may the King Mashiach, our Rebbe and our Master King Mashiach live forever and ever, and they would continue to do that, and they did that. Because even though he is dead, he could still be Mashiach. And they point to relatively obscure sources that were almost never discussed seriously in mainstream Jewish circles before the death of the Rebbe, and where the Gemara seems in one passage to entertain the possibility that the Mashiach can come from the dead. Now the fact is that the Rambam gives us a standard that would be irrelevant. If Mashiach could come from the dead, then there's never a way of applying the Rambam's halacha that you know that somebody is not Mashiach. The Rambam wrote a law which has no practical application, because im asav hitzliach v'natzach kol ha'umah shesviva, if he succeeds, then he is Mashiach b'vadei. And if he does not succeed or he's killed, then you know that this is not what the Torah meant. But if the Mashiach can come from the dead, so then when he's killed, you can say, well, he was killed, but that's just a temporary problem. He will rise from the dead and continue his mission. So then you never know when the Mashiach is not a Mashiach, because even when he's dead, he could still be the Mashiach. That's one of the clear approaches to the Rambam that makes the Rambam relevant. Without that, the Rambam is wasting his words, because clearly the Rambam understood that death is a sign of the end of the career of a potential Mashiach. Now, I could see tortured explanations of the Rambam, but here's the point. If the explanation was not dealt with seriously before the facts that you're trying to explain, then you have to really be suspicious of the explanation, right? Because there is a general consensus that Klal Yisrael has accepted for centuries by an overwhelming majority of authorities, that this Rambam is to be read the way it means, the way it obviously clearly leads you to mean, and the Rambam is a master of clarity. And all of a sudden, after the fact, when someone that you hope and believe is Mashiach dies, to say that, well, that death doesn't really mean anything, and the Rambam doesn't really mean to be saying what he's saying, and to say something else which I can't even explain because I don't understand it, that is a very dangerous thing. Let's put it this way. To the degree that someone is willing to entertain the idea that a dead person could still be Mashiach, to that degree, we are venturing very, very dangerously away from a disciplined model in which we say that we have standards that are objectively defined about who Mashiach is and who is not. The famous statement by Senator Moynihan, when he started getting whiff of serious strands of Hasidic Chabad who believed that the Rebbe could still be Mashiach, he said, for 2,000 years, the Gentile world has been told that the Jews would never accept a dead Messiah. We've been had, was his statement. Because all of a sudden, here are pious Jews who are observant of everything, Talis, Tefillin, Kashrus, Shabbos, everything, learned and so on and so forth, and they are and they're now willing to say that Mashiach can rise from the dead. So that is, in a certain sense, in a very limited sense, the redefinition of what the standards are for the Mashiach, it follows the redefinition of what the standards are for Mashiach in the times of Shabbatai Tzvi. There is a major difference in that the Rebbe never changed Jewish law, and the followers of the Rebbe never changed Jewish law, and therefore they do not use their messianism, their belief in the Rebbe as Mashiach then, or those, I don't know if they're a minority, I don't know if they're a majority, I don't know this. I know that they are a significant part of the former united body. Before the Rebbe died, there was a large group called Chabad, and a significant part of those people still to this day pay for full page ads which refer to the Rebbe as Melech Mashiach L'Olam Vod. You see, there's here, for example, New York Times. I don't have the New York Times one over here. You also find over here, you see the dialogue that I crammed together at the bottom because I wanted it all to fit on one page, where there was a statement issued by people disassociating themselves from saying that the Rebbe is Mashiach, but you notice that they don't say that it can't be, and they don't say that it shouldn't be followed. They say the preoccupation with identifying the Rebbe's Atzal as Mashiach is clearly contrary to the Rebbe's wishes. And then this chairman, Rabbi Butman, of the International Committee to Bring Mashiach, who is a major problem because he's occupying 770, he is saying, and he's also a formerly respected leader in the Chabad movement, is saying, pointing out for all the world to see that those people disassociating themselves with this statement are very carefully wording their statement not to say that the Rebbe can't be Mashiach, but that it's contrary to the Rebbe's wishes. So there's a tremendous, I would say that this is a significant issue. Now it's significant for another reason, and this is where Dr. David Berger's book comes in. And I know that people who are good friends of Chabad don't even like to hear the name David Berger mentioned in public, because he is vilified now for what he has done. He published a book in taking the entire Orthodox Jewish community to task because, says he, we, meaning people like Ilan Feldman, don't have the guts to speak up in public and decry the distortion of Jewish faith that is being done in the name of Orthodox Jews by people in Chabad, and we don't have the guts to say that we will not work with people who are Mashiachs within the camp of Chabad, and we will not trust them in positions of authority and education and communal leadership and so on and so forth. And David Berger threw down the gauntlet and said, where are you? Are we a people of faith? Are we a people that actually takes these principles seriously? Do we have a system where things are in and things are out? Do we constantly re-legislate and rework definitions of things in order to fit preconceived notions? If we are that, then there are so many issues that we claim to be willing to give our lives for that maybe we're wasting our lives about, because maybe it's not true. So the point is that we are a system of Orthodox belief, not only Orthodox halacha, and that halacha itself is codified. So what is dangerous is that when we do see these kinds of things, and we do not consider them to be an affront to the notion that there actually is a right way for Jewish faith to be understood and absorbed, and a wrong way, then we are guilty of presiding over a distortion of the notion of what it is to be a believer in God and His Torah and His oral law. So it's a very, it is a very bothersome and disturbing thing, that that phenomenon in Jewish life, and it is a mystery to me why people like me have not spoken about this regularly and often since the passing of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I will tell you, from my point of view, that one of the reasons that I don't do it is because lay people have a tendency to say that everything is politics. And therefore, they don't believe that when a rabbi says something, he says it because he's motivated by his understanding of truth. They assume that he's doing it because he's motivated by some notion of politics. It's a major occupational hazard that every rabbi from every perspective has, that he's never given credibility to be saying something because he sincerely believes it. He always has a reason other than the fact that he really believes it. So that's part of the problem is you. Because you don't believe that the rabbi really believes it, and the rabbi knows you don't believe it, therefore he can't trust you to follow him when he says something difficult to swallow. Yes? They are following halacha. Okay, I hear the complication. I'm not going to repeat it for the tape, but I hear that it's complicated. There's no question it's complicated. Yes?
Are there leaders in Chabad who are really on the other side as opposed to, like you said, these people who carefully word their statement so as not to say the Rebbe cannot be in the Mashiach?
There are people in Chabad who will openly say that they do not believe that the Rebbe is Mashiach. They will say, as far as I can determine, that you cannot deny the right of those who believe that he can be Mashiach or might be Mashiach from believing that, and that it is not an affront to Jewish faith to believe that, although I personally don't believe that. That's what they would say. There are very few Lubavitch leaders or scholars or rabbis or communal leaders who will say this is wrong. This is inconsistent with anything that any responsible Jewish community ever from the time of the destruction until today has ever believed, and it is only something that has begun to be discussed since the death of the Rebbe, and it is inconsistent with the text and the interpretation of the text by almost all authorities. They will point to obscure authorities, they will point to other things, and they will say, therefore, it's not unreasonable, and they will ignore the fact that always Jewish halakha and Jewish direction has followed the accepted norms and has rejected minority and obscure opinions. So, and they themselves, before the death of the Rebbe, never discussed the possibility of a dead Mashiach, a Mashiach who dies and then comes back. So this is a new discussion that never really saw any this light of day until after the death of the Rebbe by certain people in the Chabad movement. Not by all, and as far as I know, not by anybody in responsibility in the city of Atlanta, as far as I know. Yes? What's that? Did he ever say? So this is the video equipment that I have here, and it's very late. I have snippets of a video of 25 or 30 videos, which show a variety of things. Now that I tell you what they say, and I don't show you what they say, then you'll have to trust me, and that's not a good thing. But I will tell you that there are. I won't give you opinions. I'll tell you what some of the videos depict, and. One video depicts the Rebbe standing in the line, which people would stand to greet him as he would give out dollars at certain times, and it shows representatives, two representatives who say on the tape and audio that they are representatives of Neshe Chabad from Kfar Chabad from Israel, and they're presenting him with a petition for the Rebbe to reveal himself as a Mashiach, and the Rebbe listens to them respectfully. He does not say I will. He does not say I won't. He doesn't say I am the Mashiach, but I'm not going to reveal myself. He doesn't say anything very committal. He thanks them very much. He says Yasher Koach, and he gives them $1. I'm just saying that's what I see on the video. There is another video in which a packed room at 770 is singing very fervently Yechi Adonenu Rabbeinu Mareinu Yechi Mareinu Rabbeinu Adonenu Melech Mashiach Lelem Boed. They're singing it, and the Rebbe is walking through the aisle, and he is motioning like this with his hands. That does not mean that the Rebbe thought that they were singing that he should live forever. It might be that the Rebbe thought that they were saying that whoever is the Mashiach should live forever. There is another video of the Rebbe sitting, evidently post his first stroke, and motioning with his hands as they're singing this very, very fervently on another date. The date is there. This is a Chabad broadcast, by the way, on the worldwide broadcast that they had of many of the gatherings. And there is another video of various representatives of 770 during the life of the Rebbe saying that he's Mashiach. Like I say, there's nothing wrong with that. In Israel, the mainstream Chabad communities in Israel openly talk about the Rebbe today as being Mashiach, mainstream. And you can pick up literature at the Kotel any day about the Rebbe being a Mashiach or worse. There's one community in France that talks about the Rebbe in terms that sound to me like they think he's God. Some people claim that they don't really mean that he is God, but the terms to any reasonable person, especially an unlearned person like me, sound like they're saying that that God has gone into the Rebbe's body and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of dangerous stuff going on over here by maybe a very few people who publish a lot of pieces of paper. But there's also not a lot of vocal Chabad objection. I don't see full page ads in the New York Times opposing the assertions of those who say that the Rebbe is still Mashiach today. And that disturbs me, but I don't have the guts to talk about it publicly either. Said the word in English, this man is God?
He was in Russian.
Uh-huh.
So a pair went out.
I'm not trying to be disrespectful. Do you speak Russian or read Russian?
I'm sorry?
Do you speak Russian or read Russian?
No, I'm just telling you what the rabbis of Wisconsin did.
Okay.
The Chabad of Wisconsin, Rabbi Michal Twersky, and the Rosh Yeshiva of Witz all together signed a letter in the Jewish newspaper in Wisconsin excommunicating this particular group, saying that anybody who gives money to them is should not be giving money or whatever, where they worded it, because that's going, you know, too far. The second point I wanted to make was when I was in Israel, and after the Rebbe died, I witnessed myself a group of men dancing in joy that he had died, because they said, because I asked, that now that he had died, he could be resurrected as Melech Mashiach, which I at the time found pretty disturbing.
All right. So there are these disturbing trends. I'm not claiming that this is mainstream Chabad, and I want to get Rabbi Stern a chance to say something. I will, but whatever you say, I'm not going to respond because I don't want this to be a debate. Okay.
I practically agree with everything you said, but I did want to make a few comments. The first thing important to put into perspective about the Rebbe's life and about the videos and so on, that the Rebbe wrote that from the age of 3, when he first went to Heder, he envisioned the world of Mashiach. It's clear that the Rebbe's whole motivation throughout his life and all of the outreach and so on was all about bringing Mashiach. And the fact that the Rebbe did or didn't agree to people who say he was Mashiach, in my opinion, was because the Rebbe hoped that not he, the person, was Mashiach, but that Mashiach would come. He was a willing candidate, but he hoped that the world would come to the place that it was time for Mashiach to come. He accurately said that when a beloved person passes on, we have two choices. We come to terms with it. Sometimes it takes a little while. And other people go into denial. The one thing I will disagree with you is that it is a minority. The fact that you find a lot of pieces of paper, and the fact that you find full-page ads, and the fact that in Israel, wherever you go, you'll find signs, to me, is summed up in these last 5 lines. That is that even good rabbis, and most of these rabbis we would consider very extreme on the left in regards to the Rebbe being Mashiach and these whole issues, they can't even publish a statement that doesn't get bashed for some kind, you know, they tear apart this statement of the rabbis as if it was a Rambam, and they want to tear it apart. What happens with zealousness, as we see in the world as a whole, is when you try to fight it head on, it comes back stronger. And the approach that most of the Shulchan have taken is not to fight it, because if you put another full page out in the New York Times, they'll come back with three. Money is not an issue when you have a passion for something. Money becomes money is insignificant. Most Shulchan have taken it as their mission in life to carry on the Rebbe's legacy of spreading Yiddishkeit and continue the outreach. In the seven Chabad houses in Georgia, you'll never hear once any of the rabbis or being sanctioned by the rabbis. In fact, I know in certain Chabad houses there were people that wanted to come speak, Chabad rabbis that are generally non-partial, but they were asked not to come speak because there was a fear that they might say something that would reflect somehow or other a movement, you know, on behalf of Chabad, that this is a belief. So this is very clear that this is not a universal belief within Chabad. It is a minority. And it's something that most Chabad rabbis would agree with you, that the fact is that once a person dies, they are no longer a Mashiach. It's not possible. The Rambam says it clearly. So the fact that some people have that belief is a state. And in fact, you'll find one other fact, and this I'll toss it down, is that most of the communities where you have people believing and making their life about the Rebbe being Mashiach are communities that are people that don't really partake in the real world. They have the relationship with the Rebbe ends in their own little world of observance. They don't see the Rebbe as a global figure. They don't see the Rebbe as a global mission. It's a personal father. It's a personal relationship that ended when the Rebbe died, and the only way they can move on is by creating this image and this imaginary fantasy, which to most shluchim, most people that are part of the real world, we see the Rebbe as a much larger than life figure, something that contributes to the greater good of Yiddishkeit, and ultimately will hopefully, through our efforts, bring the Mashiach.
Got it. Thank you very much. So I will. I'm not even in response to you at all. Thank you very much. I would say that very often people make observations to me about orthodoxy, and the only way that I can know how something looks is because from the outside they tell me something which I never read. So I would say from the outside me, I'm not a Chabad person. I'm not familiar with the whole Mashiach fervor of Chabad from before the Rebbe passed away. I'm certainly not afterwards, meaning I don't know it from the inside. I don't know the sichas well, and so on and so forth. But there are certain behaviors that it would be very useful if Chabad did not engage in with ambiguity that would make it clear that when they're doing this, they're not doing it because they think the Rebbe is still alive or that he's still Mashiach, such as reading letters to newly married couples from the Rebbe without saying that the Rebbe didn't write this letter because he died in 1994. And I've been at weddings where people stand up for letters from the Rebbe, but he died 9 or 10 years ago, and now this couple didn't even know, they weren't born maybe when the Rebbe died, and the Rebbe it strains credibility. And in the context of passionate, outspoken people who are saying the Rebbe is alive, I think it is very appropriate for somebody to take the time to say, the Rebbe did not write this letter because he is dead. We mourn his passing, we celebrate his work, and we're reading a letter that he wrote when he was alive that we now think is a good idea to read now that he's dead. Something like that, as opposed to the Rebbe wrote a letter to this couple, or I have a letter from the Rebbe. I know, and the implication is he wrote it now. Those kinds of things are, in this context, are extremely dangerous, in my opinion. Especially to people who are not yet Anshei Shlomenu, who don't believe in Torah Misinai, who see Orthodox Jews believing something which is clearly frivolous. And that's really the problem here. It becomes a Chilul Hashem. And it's certainly not politics, as you know, obviously. This is a very serious matter. But thank you very much, and thanks for... I don't know how you bore sitting through this discussion with and only said one thing. You're a very strong man. Yes? That Mashiach will have a son? There's no way of knowing if that is... they're certainly not recorded that Mashiach has to have a son. And the Rambam makes reference to Mashiach living for a very long time, evidently longer than normal, which is hard to reconcile with the Rambam's assertion that nothing supernatural will happen during the times of Mashiach. But nobody says, as far as I know, that the Mashiach has to have a successor who is his son. What happens when a king of Israel doesn't have a son? So there's another way of creating a king. But when once Mashiach does his job, I don't know what happens after Mashiach perishes. Yes. If that is, it's very dangerous. It's very bad. I will say to anybody who has a complaint about hatred, division, anger, resentment, mistreatment of others, there is only one possible way to combat it, and it is not to label the behavior as inappropriate. It's to love people. So go ahead around being loving, and that will make it impossible for anybody to be the miserable people that you're observing. It's impossible for people to go around being loving and at the same time label other people as divisive. Impossible. So just be loving, and that will solve. If we all just be loving, we'll solve the problem. That's really. Thank you very much. But obviously, we have to be very careful. Okay.